There it goes. They are now firing onto the crowd. Out! They are firing rubber bullets.
Those are just some of the sounds of the city of Ferguson, Missouri last night, where people protesting the death of Michael Brown clashed with a heavily armed local police force. Images of police on armored vehicles pointing guns at demonstrators and footage of aggressive crowd control tactics have led many to ask about the growing militarization of state and local law enforcement. And we are joined now by Kara Dansky, the senior counsel at the ACLU Center for Justice and author of the ACLU's recent report on police militarization called War Comes Home. We have a link to it on our show page at WNYC.org. Kara, welcome to our show.
Thanks for having me.
In light of the research you've done, have you been surprised by the police reaction in Ferguson?
You know, it's interesting. What we're seeing in Ferguson today is in many ways a reflection of the militarization of policing that's been happening across America for decades. The police have been excessively militarized and unnecessarily aggressive in poor communities and communities of color for a very long time. And what we're seeing in Ferguson today is a reflection of that.
And where are they getting the equipment?
Well, starting in the 1980s, the police had access to billions of dollars of funding from the Justice Department, and today they have access to billions of dollars of funding from both the Justice Department and the Department of Homeland Security. What's different is that starting in the 1990s, Congress made it possible for police departments to get military weaponry directly from the U.S. Defense Department free of charge. So since the 1990s, the U.S. military has been giving local police weaponry that it has in its arsenal free of charge. And also the Defense Department is permitted to give preference to police departments that will use the military weaponry for counter-drug work. So in some ways, this is not a new problem, although we're definitely seeing an escalation.
What kind of weaponry are we talking about? Machine guns, camouflage, night vision goggles, aircraft, landmines?
Sure. Police departments have access to really anything that the military has in its arsenal that it deems appropriate for law enforcement. And there are no real meaningful restrictions on the police across America's ability to obtain military weaponry directly from DOD. There's some oversight, but most of the oversight that DOD exercises in this area is limited to tracking inventory. There's very little oversight in terms of how military weaponry is being used in communities across the country.
In some cases, local agencies are receiving heavily armored, ambush-protected vehicles. I imagine there aren't too many IEDs or landmines in Mayberry. What is this equipment supposed to be used for?
You know, the mine-resistant ambush-protected vehicles you're talking about, they're referred to as MRAPs. These are armored vehicles that are built to withstand armor-piercing roadside bombs. You're exactly right. They were built for combat in Iraq and Afghanistan, and they've been making their way back to communities across America. We're aware of around 600 such MRAPs that have found homes in communities across the country. But it's very difficult to document because there's no single source of information on this topic.
Do you know if they have them in Ferguson or what kind of equipment they've received there?
You know, it's difficult to know exactly what's going on in Ferguson in terms of what kinds of equipment the Ferguson Police Department has, what kinds of equipment the St. Louis Police Department has. There's a county, the county law enforcement agency there and the state police arm. So there's a lot going on in Ferguson, and it's a little bit difficult to pinpoint exactly what kind of equipment they're using and where it came from.
Have most law enforcement agencies around the country asked for military-grade equipment?
All law enforcement agencies that I'm aware of have access, and I don't know the exact number of law enforcement agencies that have applied, but there really are no restrictions on the kinds of law enforcement agencies that can obtain this kind of equipment.
Is it your sense that once a department acquires this kind of equipment, it feels it has to use it?
Well, in fact, there's a built-in incentive to use it. The program requires police departments that get this kind of weaponry to use it within 1 year. So the incentive to use it is built right into the program.
So you got to bring out the tank.
You got to bring out the tank.
Even if there's no reason to roll out that tank.
That's the requirement, that they use it within a year. So there's a built-in incentive to use the equipment. But I should also say that I've talked with a number of law enforcement officers who say that exactly what you suggested is true. If the police have this weaponry, they're going to use it.
Are local law enforcement officers also receiving military-type training to use this equipment?
Well, what we saw during the course of our investigation was that local police departments are often receiving training that trains them to think of the people that they are supposed to serve as enemies, that the police are being trained to view communities as battlefields and to operate as though they're going into combat. And we see this reflected often in statements that police departments make in recruitment videos, in training videos. This information is widely available, and the conclusion that we draw from this is that there's a culture of militarism in policing that really encourages the police to think about the communities that they're supposed to be protecting and serving more as combat zones. And I've spoken with a number of members of the law enforcement community who are really concerned about this.
They are encouraged to develop or adopt a warrior mentality, you say. We the public are the enemy. Is that why we're starting to see so many? I don't think a chokehold has anything to do with this kind of thing. But do you think that attitudes are changing among police departments around the country?
You know, historically there has been a fairly clear line between local police and the military, and there's a reason for that, which is that police are there to protect and serve communities, and the military is there to protect our country from foreign invasion. And there's a very good reason to keep those two distinct. We don't want our police thinking of us as enemies.
My guest is Kara Dansky, senior counsel at the ACLU Center for Justice and author of the ACLU's recent report on police militarization called War Comes Home. You analyzed more than 800 SWAT team deployments for this report. What kinds of things are SWAT teams typically being deployed for now? Is this all war on drugs related?
Well, it's interesting that you ask. SWAT and other paramilitary teams were created in the 1960s to deal with real emergency situations that police departments at the time were not equipped or capable of handling, such as active shooter situations, barricade, hostage-taking situations like that. But what we've seen over time, increasingly, is the use of SWAT and other kinds of paramilitary teams and tactics to engage in ordinary law enforcement. And what we saw in the course of our investigation, and as you say, we examined just over 800 paramilitary raids, was an overwhelming use of paramilitary tactics and equipment to engage in ordinary law enforcement, such as serving warrants on people's homes, often for some fairly small amounts of drugs. And I should also say, this has been going on for quite some time. And what we saw in our investigation is that of the 800 SWAT deployments that we studied, people of color were disproportionately likely to be impacted by those paramilitary raids.
Can you describe how these raids often play out for the people inside the homes? Is there usually a certain amount of violence involved? Because I've heard that battering rams are even used, and they come in with guns automatically pointing at anyone.
You know, we should understand that this can be an extremely traumatic event for the people who experience it. You're exactly right. These often happen late at night, so the people will be asleep in their homes. The police will arrive, again, to do something like serve a search warrant, often for small amounts of drugs. They often arrive in an armored vehicle, which they will pull into the neighborhood and you know, into the driveway, into the street, in front of the home. 10-20 more officers, heavily armed with assault rifles, often wearing uniforms that are designed for combat, will break down the door, often using a battering ram or some other device that's used to break into somebody's home.
Why not knock or simply break the door open with a stiff shoulder as they do in the movies?
Well, that's a good question. But what we're seeing is that it's commonplace to engage in these kind of paramilitary tactics. And you're right. They often will deploy what is referred to in the industry as a distraction device. Sometimes these are called flashbang grenades. These cause temporary blindness, deafness, and confusion. The police will go in, point assault rifles at people, order everyone to shut up, get on the ground. This can be extremely traumatic for the people who experience it. And again, this happens, we estimate, around 50,000 times every year in America.
The flash bangs are being used in Ferguson, aren't they?
You know, things are changing so quickly in Ferguson. I am not aware of whether flashbang grenades are being used in Ferguson. I haven't seen that, but it's certainly possible.
How do the SWAT deployments affect the neighborhoods in which they're happening? Because you describe an incident in which a SWAT team in Arizona shot a war veteran 22 times while they were conducting raids on other people's houses. And then they let him die in his own kitchen.
And when you live in a neighborhood where there's a SWAT raid or other paramilitary raid on a home in the neighborhood frequently, daily or weekly, it has a destabilizing effect on the neighborhood. And, you know, I mentioned earlier, I've spoken to members of law enforcement who are deeply concerned about the impact of the militarization of policing on their ability to do their job, because when they engage in unnecessarily aggressive, unnecessarily militaristic tactics, that tends to undermine public trust. It tends to erode public confidence in law enforcement, and it makes it much more difficult for the police to do their job, which is to protect and serve communities.
What happened in that incident with the war veteran being shot 22 times?
It was a paramilitary raid similar to the ones that I've described. You know, and the subject of war veterans being subjected to these paramilitary raids, this is sadly not uncommon. There's another case in Utah in which an Iraq veteran was using marijuana in his home, personal use, and the police obtained a search warrant to serve a warrant on his home, and they did so in the middle of the night, as is quite commonplace. And this young man had a gun in his home, and when the police raided his home, he pulled his gun and shot a few officers, tragically, absolutely tragically. They charged him with a crime. He was sent to jail, and while in jail, he hung himself. And I should say he was using marijuana for PTSD because of his experiences in combat. So we really need to understand this is an extremely traumatic situation for people to experience, and it happens again over and over throughout communities in America.
In the report, you also document numerous instances in which SWAT teams deployed when there are children present, and even some raids in which the SWAT team knew in advance that children would be present. What's the justification used for those types of raids when it's known that there are kids in the house?
You know, there's a horrific example that happened very recently in a small town outside Atlanta, Georgia, in which a SWAT team came in, again, to serve a search warrant for a pretty small amount of drugs, and there was a two-year-old baby in a crib, and his three sisters were in the living room at the same time, and they conducted this raid. They threw a flashbang grenade into the home. There were toys in the yard. There was a minivan in the driveway. There were several indications that the police should have known there were children, and they threw this flashbang grenade into the home, and it landed in the crib, critically injuring, again, tragically, this two-year-old boy.
And what were the police looking for?
A small amount of drugs, which they didn't find. They didn't find the drugs, they didn't find any weapons, and they didn't find the person they were looking for. They eventually found that man in a different home.
Is this the militarization of the police, is this militarization happening uniformly across the country, or are there particular states or locations and localities which have particularly embraced military equipment and tactics?
Well, you know, this gets at something that we highlighted in our report, which is there's a real data gap here, resulting from the fact that the police are not required to report on their use of paramilitary weapons and equipment. So when we did our investigation, we looked, you know, as you know, at just over 800 SWAT raids over the course of 2 years from a couple hundred police departments. This is a tiny, tiny sliver of the deployment of paramilitary teams and the use of paramilitary weapons and tactics throughout the country. So much more work needs to be done. The police really need to be required to report on their use of paramilitary weapons and tactics. They need to report on the impact of their use of paramilitary weapons and tactics, particularly in communities of color, which have borne the brunt of the militarization of policing. And we need to have this data available so that we can study it, because there's really no central repository for information on the militarization of policing across the country.
Is it just people of color? Because you note that Maricopa County in Arizona has a massive cache of military-grade weapons, including over 1,000 guns, 64 armored vehicles, and 32 bomb suits. Isn't that Joe Arpaio's police force?
Joe Arpaio is the sheriff in Maricopa County. That's true.
And is there concern about illegal immigrants or Mexican-American crime?
Well, you know, you asked if it's only people of color who are bearing the brunt of this. You know, the militarization of policing is a problem throughout the country, and we saw over and over again the culture of militarism that seems to permeate many police departments. Though I should say, not all police departments. There are many police officers who are speaking out against this, and as I said, who are very concerned about the militarization of policing. It's not only people of color who are harmed by this, but for the last several decades, we have seen a relentless war on drugs fought mostly in communities of color, and the militarization of policing is another aspect of that. People of color and communities of color unfairly bear the brunt.
Although, luckily, we haven't seen any tanks in New York streets recently. Kara Dansky,
I'm happy for that.
Kara Dansky is the author of the ACLU's recent report on police militarization called War Comes Home. I have to assume that officers feel they need to use SWAT tactics because they believe they're entering a very dangerous situation. Do weapons turn up in most of the homes that are raided?
When we did our investigation, that's actually not what we found. We found instead that the police were using SWAT and other forms of paramilitary weapons and tactics, often to serve search warrants. And they would do so often on the basis that the situation was, quote unquote, high risk. But the problem is that they often didn't explain why they thought the situation was high risk or what high risk meant in that scenario. And we found a shocking number of incidents in which the police would raid a home, traumatize the people who were in the home, and not find the weapons or drugs that they claimed would be there.
Small towns like Aurora and Newtown have had heavily armed men attack and indiscriminately kill large numbers of innocent people. Isn't there a case to be made that law enforcement should have some of these military-grade tools and SWAT training, considering that we live in an era of the mass shooter?
You know, the thing is that's actually not what we're talking about when we talk about the militarization of policing. We're talking about the 50,000 paramilitary raids that happen every year in America. That breaks down to about 125 raids on people's homes every day. These are violent raids, and again, they're happening increasingly for purposes that they were never created for, like serving search warrants. So when we talk about the militarization of policing in America, we're really talking about the inappropriate use of paramilitary weapons in communities in ways that undermine public trust in law enforcement and that put people at risk of danger.
Is it your sense that American law enforcement has gone through a cultural change in recent years? Is that due to the post 9/11 political climate or movies and TV, video games?
Well, I definitely think that the problem of militarization of policing predates 9/11. I think it's been going on at least since the 80s and 90s, certainly in communities of color. But I also do think that it has expanded since 9/11 and the creation of the Department of Homeland Security. You know, we should say that the local police have access to virtually unlimited military equipment through the Defense Department's 1033 program. But in addition, the police have access to billions of dollars worth of funding from the Department of Justice and the Department of Homeland Security that they can then use to buy weapons directly from weapons manufacturers above and beyond what they get for free from the Defense Department. So I think that that's right. I think this is not a new problem. The problem's been going on for a very long time. It's been underdocumented and underreported, but it has expanded since 9/11. And certainly, as we're seeing increasingly, these MRAPs, the mine-resistant ambush-protected vehicles that you spoke of earlier, coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, this is getting a lot more public attention. It's getting more attention in the media. And I think that that's a good thing. I think that the people have a right to know how they're being policed. I think that the people have a right to a lot more information about the militarization of policing across the country. And I think that there are solutions to the problem. We're calling on Congress to rein in some of these programs, these federal programs that are fueling the militarization of police. We're also calling on state and local governments to put some constraints on the ability of the police to engage in paramilitary weapons and tactics in their communities.
So the same kind of equipment that originally was being used in Iraq and Afghanistan that was intended for places like Fallujah is now showing up in small towns all across America. Why is the Department of Homeland Security giving grants to small towns? Is there a real fear that terrorists, domestic or foreign, are going to attack Montpelier?
You know, it's interesting that you used a town in Vermont. There's a small town in New Hampshire that applied to the Department of Homeland Security for a $300,000 grant to buy an armored vehicle. And in their application, they said that they had a concern about terrorism in this small town in New Hampshire, and they got the grant and they bought the armored vehicle. When they were later asked, why did you say that there's a concern about terrorism in our small town? The response, the government response was, well, you know, we had to say that in order to get the DHS money, but we really only said that in order to get the money. What red-blooded American cop wouldn't want a toy like this? So in order to get the DHS funding, the police do have to say that they intend to use it for counterterrorism purposes. Whether they actually intend to do so is a different story.
Have things changed as we've gone from the Bush to the Obama administration, or has this actually been increasing?
It's definitely been increasing over time. I certainly haven't seen any reduction in the proliferation of weapons and money from the federal government between the Bush administration and the Obama administration. So we haven't seen any change that we know of.
Has there been any oversight about how military equipment is being used here in the United States?
There's almost no oversight, and that's another problem that we looked into in our investigation. There's almost no oversight at the local, state, or federal level. We think that's a big problem, and we're calling on government at all levels to exercise more oversight over into the militarization of policing. There's a bill before Congress now that would require much more extensive reporting than currently exists over the administration of the 1033 program.
You say this has been going on for a while. Why are we only having a national discussion about it now?
That's a great question. We were really hoping that our report would bring some public attention to this problem. That's been going on for a very long time. We hope that it did.
What about the Supreme Court and other courts? Have any rulings been made that have made these kinds of raids easier?
Part of the problem in terms of seeking a judicial remedy is that the people who are victimized by paramilitary raids on their homes often don't have the funds to hire a lawyer to file suit to challenge the paramilitary raid on their homes. So it's very difficult for people to get into court in the first place. Even for people who are able to get into court in the first place, these cases are often thrown out at a very early stage of the process. So most of the cases don't even make it to the point of having legal rulings that would rein in some of these inappropriate tactics.
Kara, we have very little time, but I was wondering whether it's just military weapons. What about surveillance equipment?
That's definitely another aspect of this. We focused on military equipment for the purpose of our report, but I think that it's a completely legitimate question to ask what kinds of surveillance equipment are local police departments getting from DOD.
Kara Dansky is the senior counsel at the ACLU Center for Justice and the author of the ACLU's recent report on police militarization called War Comes Home. Kara, thank you so much for being on our show.
Thanks for having me.
It's something that we will continue following on the Leonard Lopate Show.